right, folks, we've been cleared for takeoff. Give me a hell, give me a yell. Stand up right now and give me a hell, give me a yell. Stand up right now, get ready to go. She ain't moving slow, she's taking control. Pushing the pedal through the floor. I'm begging for more, you better hold on tight.
And look now, it's Flight Deck, podcast dedicated to Montreal Alouettes football. I am your host, Tim Capper, along with Cliffy D. How was your week?
My week was fantastic, Tim. I got to spend the weekend watching football, and I get to spend this week talking about football. And this weekend, I will likely watch some more football because it's June now. It's the time of year to be watching football. It's the time of year to be talking about football. It's the time of year to be doing pretty much everything football. So I say we take full advantage of it.
You sound so happy, Cliff. you were lucky enough to be able to attend the scrimmage this past weekend over in Lennoxville. It was something that the Alouettes changed from last year where they held it in St. Hubert. How was it attended fan-wise? I mean, remember this – what people need to remember is that this was actually done at a very, very early time compared to what it was last year and compared to what it was for the opening day for camp 2 weeks ago. What was the attendance like for fans, at least?
Surprisingly, it was not bad. I will say that. It's kind of funny, though, because they had listed a start time of 8:30. So right. I figure, okay, got to get there on the bright and be ready to go, which is fine. I have no problem with that. I mean, yeah, I do love sleeping in on Saturdays. But for Alouettes football, I'll get up at the crack of dawn if I need to. But I get there. And, yeah, there's a few folks there, and everybody's raring to go and all that. And it's all good. And like, it's 8:30, 8:45. About to 9 o'clock, and still not a whole lot happening. And I'm like, this is unusual. Like, you can see a couple of players kind of milling about, and yeah, just nothing going on. It seems like there's more still getting ready more than anything else. And then finally, getting close to about 10 o'clock, and then finally, or 9:30, and that's when the players start coming out to warm up for this scrimmage game. Things didn't get going until about 10 o'clock, so I don't know why they suggested everybody be there at 8:30. Yeah. If you're only going to get cracking at just after, it was just after 10 o'clock when things finally got underway. So I found that be a bit of a head scratcher, but you know, it is what it is. But at the end of the day, I'm there to watch football. So I got to see football. I'm happy.
And this is the one thing, like normal, I think this was, Telus was the main sponsor for the scrimmage. So I am too. I'm very surprised. I mean, did they have anything else? For those who weren't able to attend, anything else besides that? Was it done just like a normal game? Did they play the national anthem? Did they have any cheerleaders there? Or was it just the kiosk for the red zone?
Well, that was definitely there as well. But they did play the national anthem. They did have a bagpiper in to sort of escort the players onto the field. But aside from that, there wasn't a whole lot of – like if you were to compare it to last year's event, which was an actual event unto itself.
Yeah, it was.
And it was put on – and I thought it was really well done. So I was very disappointed to see that they didn't continue it, especially since there was – like last year, they were up against F1 weekend in Montreal. This last weekend, there was nothing going on in the city other than the Tour de Lille, which, again, always can create a bit of havoc. But, I mean, nothing that should have prevented anyone from stepping up and saying, hey, Alouettes – come to our field and let's get fans excited like you did last year. Instead, they just went back to the same old go to Lennoxville and just do like a regular scrimmage, which, again, for a diehard football fan, you're going to love that. But your average kind of person on the fence that doesn't know if they want to really partake in a game or what have you, or it's just kind of still kind of curious about Alouettes football or whatever, like this, that would have been a prime opportunity to get these people here. But I mean, if you do it out in Lennoxville, if you live out that way, that's great. But I mean, if you're in the city of Montreal, you don't want to schlep all the way down to an hour and a half down the road necessarily, unless you absolutely positively want to see it. Like the diehards are going to go see it no matter what. But if you want to try and get that casual fan interested in it, then this was unfortunately a bit of a misstep from the organization.
Right. And we'll continue with that. I have a couple more questions to that, but I just want to bring everybody up to speed on what we're planning on doing this week. We actually do have an interview this week. I was ecstatic that I was able to pull this thing off for us, especially for us, a rookie show like we are, and only two shows in. It is Owls related, but it's also very, very CFL related, Cliff. Well, we have Steve Daniel. He is the CFL's head statistician, and him and I had a very interesting conversation, which we will play for you in a little while. I know you've already listened to it, very eye opening. But we'll talk about that more. We'll talk about that more once we play the interview for you guys and we come back. We're talking about Lenoxville, and as far as I remember, being the Alouettes fan that I have been for the past 20+ years. The only places that I've known for them to actually hold training camp has been either Lenoxville or over in Saint-Jean-sur-Richelieu. Because I sound like you've been to many, many more training camp than I have. Because to be unfair, and I think I mentioned this last week, I've only been to three. I've only been to three times, and two of them were in the past 2 years. What is your take on where and how the Owls? How they control basically where training camp's going to be held, and is it the right place for training camp to be held? You look at some of the other teams in the CFL, Cliff, as you know, Ottawa does it in Ottawa. Edmonton does it in Edmonton. As far as I know, Saskatchewan does it, they're doing it in Saskatoon, I think.
Yes, they are.
Yeah, they're doing it in Saskatoon. I think of all the places, I think it is Kamloops the farthest for everybody to have to go if it were a training camp? I don't know how far Saskatoon is from Regina, so. But
if I'm not mistaken, it's a couple of hours. Just like I think Kamloops is a couple hours from the Vancouver area.
Isn't Kamloops isn't it like three?
Something like that. Yeah.
I think that's what I mean by the farthest location. Did I forget any of the teams? Calgary? Did they do it in Calgary?
They do it in Calgary. Pretty much every team, with the exception of Montreal, Saskatchewan, and Vancouver, BC. Pretty much every other team will do it in their home stadium, or at least very close to it.
Right. So what's your thought on that? I said, you've been to many of these camps here for the Alouettes, and just mentioning what you just did, you know, last year they had it over in St. Hubert. This year they had the scrimmage back where it was, where I guess it's been since they've been over in Lenoxville. Do you think that having the team having it in Lenoxville is the right thing to do, or do they need to go ahead and move it to another location?
Well, and I sort of talked about this last year in the alternative, is that what I would love to see the team do is have their first day of camp at Percival Molson Stadium. I really think if you really truly want to get people excited about football, have at the very least the first day of camp in their own stadium.
Right.
There's no, as far as I can tell, there's no logical reason why this shouldn't happen. And quite frankly, people that live in Montreal itself, you make an event out of it. You get people really excited about it. Make it like an open house where people can come check out the practices, buy merchandise, check out the stadium itself, make sure that, you know, if they're thinking about getting season tickets, they can sort of take a look and find out from their vantage point where the next potential seats could be. I mean, there's a ton of opportunity, as far as I'm concerned, to have training camp in Montreal itself for the very first day.
Right.
Now, the rest of the time, I would say absolutely go to Lenoxville, because at the end of the day, Montreal is very much a city of temptation. There's a lot of vices here. So I can understand, like, a young player coming up from America and they go to and they see, like, you know, liquor stores that are open till 11 o'clock at night, and you go to the, you know, pretty much things are 24 hours, and there's a lot of other adult temptations within the city itself. So I can understand why the organization would want to keep the players as sequestered from that as possible. That being said, first day at camp in Montreal, and yes, the rest of it in a place like Lenoxville, which, again, you'd have to try hard to get in trouble there, quite right. frankly. Even though it's a little college town, it's a lot harder to get in trouble there than it would be, say, going to Crescent Street or something like that, mm-hmm. or going along St. Catherine Street. And you'll find trouble there if you want it bad enough. Whereas in Lenoxville, no, you're not going to find that. But I would say, like, weekends, as much as possible, being in the city would make, I think, a world of difference, and just help build up the momentum for the season to start, especially this year when you consider the fact that the Montreal Canadiens didn't make the playoffs. The Montreal Impact, yeah, they were playing as well, but at the same time, like, this is a chance for these other teams to really take advantage of the situation. The fact that there is no major hockey right now that people are caring about, unless you're a diehard Penguins fan or a Sharks fan, you're really not giving a whole lot of thought to the Stanley Cup final. This would have been the perfect opportunity, in my opinion, to really capture the imaginations of fans, and not just the diehard fans, but just those casual fans that may be thinking about going to a game but not sure. Like, well, give them a chance to see some exciting football, give them a chance to get to know the players, which they would do at camp as well. And to me, it just seems like a win-win as far as I'm concerned.
Well, obviously they weren't able to know that the Canadians weren't going to be in the playoffs, and I'm sure everything was already set in place and set into motion of where they were going to have it, because I think they had announced that they were going to have it in Lennoxville well before the Canadians weren't in the playoffs. Was it March when they announced it, I think?
But let's be honest, though. By February, the Canadians were pretty much out of it.
Oh, yes, yeah. But as I said, it could be a one-off. I mean, the last time that no Canadian teams were in the playoffs was it the late 90s, if I remember correctly. I think it was the late 90s that all the Canadian teams didn't make it in. But either way, it's with Saint-Jean, at least it was technically closer. They housed them over at, was the RMC, right?
That's correct.
And here they're doing it at Bishop's. Now, obviously they want to have it a place where it could be like you're going to get to know your new teammates. It's camaraderie type of thing. But if we were to look elsewhere within the Montreal area or Montreal metropolitan community, because we know that the Montreal metropolitan community goes all the way out as far as St. Jerome. Mm-hmm. Is there a possibility, if you were to suggest a place, that the Owls would go and possibly make this, I don't want to say easier for the fans to make it out there, because if you're a diehard fan, as you said, you're going to go out there and you're going to watch football no matter what. But to make it a little bit easier, why have to, I'm sure it would be easier to think, let's have it have it in St. Jerome. I can't remember if there was a place there that they could have it. Obviously, they're looking for a field. They're looking for the facilities. They're looking for they're looking to make sure that they have everything necessary for the teams to be able to come and be able to travel without making it too hard on them when they have to, because think about it. They're going to have to go 2 hours to come into Montreal just to catch a flight to go to Winnipeg.
That's right.
So my thought would be, if you can think of one, and same thing with you guys who are listening to the podcast, let us know, obviously. If you were to suggest a place, where do you think that the Alouettes could go ahead and potentially look at? Because as far as I know, everything around, less Concordia University and McGill, there are no major CIS football teams that are around here that they are sites that they could do it. Now, mind you, RMC is different. But what do you think? I mean, what's stopping them from practicing at the Big O on the fields out there? Maybe it leads to a point too now, Cliff, is it time for the Owls to get their own practice facility? We have heard many a time where the Owls, for whatever reason, have had to switch locations and bus over to Concordia for practice. But again, first, is there a location that you would suggest that would meet that criteria? I mean, maybe something that we'll have to ask Mark Whiteman when we get him on the podcast. But what do you think? I mean, is there one that you can think of?
One that would step into my mind immediately would be where they had their very first training camp in 1996 when they returned from Baltimore. Would be at my alma mater of John Abbott College out in St. Anne de Bellevue. In that sense, you would still be in the Montreal area. Mm-hmm. You'd still be a bit far away. You wouldn't be so easily accessible to downtown. I mean, right. It's still about a good 30 minutes or so from the campus to downtown itself. So, yeah. I mean, it's not just an easy rip down from camp for these guys if they really want to go down. And you would have pretty much everything that you were looking for there. You would have the same sort of amenities, if you will, mm-hmm. That you would have over at Bishop's, and you'd still be a lot closer as well.
Yeah, I think, yeah, because I think also since that point, I think Abbott's Sejep team, their football team, I think they have more than one football team now. I'm trying to remember here because I know that I don't remember where Abbott is when it comes to their ranking in college football here in or junior college football, whatever you want to call it. Just trying to make it clear to everybody that it's our college football is not the same as it is in the rest of the country.
Just know.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's a good idea. I had totally forgotten that they were over at John Abbott. I just can't think of, I just want to try to make it easier for Joe Fan. You want to be able to go out there and enjoy it. I mean, what was stopping them from going to St. Hubert besides amenities? I think it was amenities out there. It's why they didn't, because I think, as we saw, they bust everybody in. I remember there was like two, three, or four buses that they bust everybody in. So
that's right. That would be pretty much it. Is that there's no like campus, if you will, or no place where they can really, you know, have the players stay and go to meetings or sleep or anything like that. So
right.
That's why, like, as for they were trying to sell this as like a one-off event and to really generate interest in fans. And I honestly truly think they did a great job because they attracted close to 1,000 fans for that, which, again, people in Saskatchewan and Edmonton and all that are probably laughing, thinking, okay, 1,000 fans, that's cute. But honestly, when you consider that was during Grand Prix weekend here mm-hmm. in Montreal,
yeah,
beautiful summery conditions. I mean, you're talking about fantastic weather and nothing beats being downtown Montreal in the summertime. So just the fact that you're able to attract this many people in a city like Montreal is, I honestly thought it was a win as far as administratively and, you know, from a, what do you call it? A marketing sense, you really had a chance to connect with fans. And I think a lot of people were really excited about that. So when they announced that they weren't going to have the scrimmage game in St. Hubert or anywhere close to Montreal, I could see there was a lot of disappointment there. And I don't blame them because, yeah, diehards definitely will go to Lennoxville.
Right.
But not everybody's a diehard. Not everybody thinks about, you know, wants to get up at 8:30 in the morning and drive all the way, especially if you're living in Montreal, you don't want to drive all the way out to Lennoxville, get up at the crack of dawn just to drive up to Lennoxville just to watch a scrimmage game. Like, that's, like I said, unless you love football with every fiber of your being, you're not doing that. And to expect, you know, Joe Fan to go and do that, that's expecting a lot, quite frankly.
Yeah.
So that's why, like I said, first day of training camp and pretty much weekend stuff, anything on the weekends, like a scrimmage or a preseason game or anything like that, it's got to be done in the city itself. I mean, if you really, truly want to touch the fans, if you really want to get them involved, get them engaged, that's how you got to do it. And you got to really attract the core of them. And that's where it's going to be, is on the island of Montreal itself.
It makes me wonder. I mean, as I said, maybe something that if we can get Mark Whiteman on the show, we'll ask him that particular question, and you know why it is that Lennoxville is the choice for training camp, as it has been for over since they moved from Saint Jean. So it makes me wonder. A lot happened, not only in the CFL, but it's particularly with the Owls too. But there seems to be a word that has been looming around quite a bit in the CFL, and it came around and it bit the Alouettes, and that happened to be retirement. And it was a retirement that the Owls really did not see coming because of the importance of the position that this guy was playing, and that's why they brought him in. You know, Dominic Picard, he retired on Friday. And as most of you know, he was actually going to be the guy who was going to be replacing Luc Brodeur-Jourdain at center while he was still recovering from his knee surgery. Now, you know, remember, he's not been cleared. If I remember correctly, Cliff, he hasn't been cleared yet.
Not yet.
Yeah, so he's basically sidelined indefinitely. You know, they signed him as a free agent from Winnipeg, but obviously never expecting that he would retire 6 days into camp. We've noticed this, by the way, just as I said, throughout the CFL. This really does, at first, it does put them in a loop. It did throw them for a loop, but luckily for the Alouettes, they did have a little bit of a contingency plan, so to speak, and they were able to just continue on with camp, right?
That's correct. I mean, yeah, it definitely was a bit of a surprise because, like you said, Picard was brought in to sort of lighten the load and at least keep Luc Brodeur-Jallet's seat warm at the center position. So his abrupt retirement definitely kind of sends him into a bit of a shock. But as we've seen the past couple of days, it just becomes a case of next man up. And in this case, the next man up is Christian Matt, who was the Alouettes' first round draft pick back in 2011. And he's been with the team now for a couple of years, and he's been a bit of a jack of all trades. Like he's paid his
dues too. I mean, he was not on. I think he at one point he wasn't on the active roster. He was a huge guy in the community and stuff like that. And he finally got his chance.
That's correct. And he's done it all. Like he's played guard, he's played tackle, and he's even last year when Luke went down to injury at the game in Edmonton, he ended up filling in in the center position and did quite well for himself. So I was actually pleasantly surprised to see that the Alouettes must have remembered that and slotted him in there, and now they're giving him a chance to excel at that position, and it also too opens things up for one of the new guys. You're talking about guys like Philippe Gagnon, who was drafted this year, Matthew Toppin, also drafted this year, and then you also have guys that were drafted last year, such as Quinn Lawler. Like these guys are now going to get a chance to slot into various positions and see what works. And quite frankly, that's the attitude you got to have. Is okay, we lose a guy. Well, who's going to go in next? Who's going to step up and take that spot for the offensive line? And that's what you're looking at right now. And at the end of the day, we've still got quite a good core of young Canadian players on that line. And I don't think it's going to be quite the doom and gloom that a couple of scribes have suggested that it might be. I mean, it's a bit of a setback losing someone like Picard because he does bring the experience and, again, is a national player as well, which, as you can attest, you can't have too many good national players, especially along the offensive line. But I think at the end of the day, yeah, there's going to be a few bumps along the road. You're going to get a few growing pains. But I think when it's all said and done, I think we're going to be just fine as far as the offensive line goes in Montreal.
Yeah, I heard Drakowski mention in his story, talking about, you know, the scrimmage that you were at, that Matt was at center, Philip Blake moved from right to left guard, and Philippe Gagnon was starting at right guard. He talked about, I think he said, you know, Jacob Ruby. The Alouettes have always been known to have a all-Canadian starting line, at least in the past, well, long while that I remember, right?
Yeah, I mean, you'd have to go back at least a couple of years to see someone who was born in the United States of America just playing on the line, never mind starting every single game. So yeah, I mean, you'd be going back quite a while. Like exactly. This is something that Jim Pappas has, you know, that's pretty much his bread and butter, is finding these good players from out of nowhere, but more importantly, building that offensive line and keeping it as Canadian as possible.
Right. You know, lost train of thought. Before Brodeur-Jourdain, it was Brian Chu, if I remember correctly. Or did I forget somebody in between? Because Chu hasn't been out of the Alouettes organization that long. Did I forget anybody?
You're forgetting Paul Lambert.
Paul Lambert. Yep, you're right. Correct. So they've always been able to find somebody to make, you know, to get it, to be able to fill in these spots. And it's true that Christian Matt was somebody who has been showing that he can fill in, especially at the center position, and is able to do it very well. Too early, do you think? Is it too early for the Owls to go after somebody? Because, I mean, you're not going to think of having a trade. You know, they're going to bring in guys. I mean, the Alouettes are still bringing in guys and taking guys off the roster. You know, do you think it's unheard of that the Owls would trade this early on in preseason for a backup at center? Because my thought is this, because I'm sure you got a copy of the depth chart when you were there.
Absolutely.
Okay. Did it show anybody that you can remember, unless you have it in front of you, who is next on the depth chart for center? Who, or at least who can step in, and God forbid, if Christian Matt gets hurt?
At this point, it would be Matthew Toppin, who was, like I said, drafted this year in the eighth round. Okay. I would say, honestly, from what I've seen of this kid in his highlight reels, Remember the name Ryan Bauman?
Yeah.
This guy very much cut of the Ryan Bauman cloth. He played for Guelph. He dominated, and he's even scored a touchdown too. Like, I mean, he's just one of those jack of all trade types as well, which, again, at the end of the day, you have to be that way. You have to be as versatile as possible. And that's only going to be good for this young man, because if he has to step in at center, great, he can do that. If he has to swing him out to tackle or guard, no problem. Mm-hmm. He seems to be able to do that as well. Like, he did a lot of that when he was playing at Guelph, and God forbid Christian Mack gets hurt, this guy could definitely step in as well. You also still have Jake Piotrowski as well, who has been with the Alouettes for the past couple of years, also drafted by them. And again, like, these guys, if nothing else, offensive line coach Chris Sweet will have these guys ready to step in at a moment's notice. Like, that's just how he drills these guys. He gets them fired up. And at the end of the day, he's also educating them as well. Like, he's trying to make a more versatile, more well-rounded player out of all of his young charges. And you see the work that he puts in for that day in and day out. If you go to camp, you see the work that these offensive line guys do. And that's why I'm, like I said, I'm not stressed. Concerned? Yeah, there's always going to be concern.
Right.
But to think that it's doom and gloom, or to think that the Alouettes have to rush out and make a trade out of haste or out of necessity or anything like that, no, we don't have to do that. Montreal is going to be okay. It's not going to be perfect. And like I said, because these are still young men that are still sort of learning the game at a professional level, you're going to run into a few bumps along the road. That's to be expected. That's normal. But this is also how you learn as well. Like, look, last year, Rakeem Cato got thrown into the fire, and he managed to survive. He had moments of brilliance. He had moments of not so brilliance, but he managed to make it work. And these guys will do that as well. If and when their number is called, I fully expect them to be able to step up and get in there and get to work.
Jim Pop's already mentioned that Kevin Glenn's going to start. I know we're talking about the game itself, but that Kevin Glenn is going to start, and that Brandon Bridge is going to back him up versus Winnipeg tomorrow. When you were there for the scrimmage, how do the quarterbacks look?
I got to say, I was extremely impressed with Vernon Adams. Just what he does is fluid. It's very fluid, and he doesn't panic. Like, he's got that perfect ability to just, see what everything that's in front of him and make plays happen. If nothing else, he's going to take his shots and not be afraid to take his shots. And you want that. You want a bit of that gunslinger mentality as well when you're out there on the field. And he inspires his teammates. Like, they want to play for him. Like, his receivers, when they're lining up, the one that immediately comes to mind is Jerry Rice Jr. Those two have been finding a really great connection over the past couple of days at training camp. Right. And I fully expect to see that tomorrow as well when the Alouettes take on the Blue Bombers. I'm definitely seeing a connection right there. Taj Boyd also playing at the quarterback position. He too, the fundamentals are right there. And same idea. Like, he knows how to command a high power offense, and you give him some good weapons, I think he'll make plays happen as well.
I think it'd be tough to, considering how many quarterbacks we still have on our roster, and then being able to get the playing time that's going to be necessary for the coaches to be able to say, okay, well, we're keeping you, and you, because we know it's usually three quarterbacks that they keep, and it's not uncommon that they could keep four, but they will have somebody on the practice team. It's just a weird situation. I understand that we're basically, Montreal's been in flux when it comes to a quarterback ever since AC retired. And I think any Owls and any CFL fan will agree with me on that. Just got to find that next one. We just got to find that next one. It's very interesting. We always be, I think of anything else though, Cliff, compared to what we've seen from some of the other teams, the Owls are actually quite lucky that their injuries are not as bad as some of these other teams that I've seen so far in the CFL preseason. A lot of these teams are really, really banged up compared to us.
Well, that's it. It's not just banged up too, but also too, like, you look at guys that go down and do they have replacements? Whereas I look at the depth chart right now, or the position chart, I should say, and there's a lot of guys that can slot in, no problem, and that's what you need. And this is what you could question a lot of what Jim Pop does, And you'd be justified in doing so. But the one thing you can't question is the fact that he will definitely go and find the right amount of talent to be able to put together a well-balanced roster. And when you look at some of the names, like maybe they don't jump out at you. They're not exactly household names. But once you see the work that they do, once you see them actually take to the field and get in the trenches, you say, okay, this guy belongs here. This guy has potential. And you're not as stressed about it. You're not as worried about, okay, do we need to go get someone? Do we need to go find someone? And to me, that's where you see a lot of the strength in Montreal as an organization, not just with the head coach and general manager, but also with their scouting staff as well, because they're out there finding these guys as well. And like I said, they may not be household names. They may not be names that immediately jump out at you. But once you see them in the uniform and playing this game,
right,
you'll feel a lot better knowing that, okay, so-and-so may have gone down to injury, but hey, you know what? We got this. And like I said, next man up. That's how you got to look at it. And these guys, too, are jumping at the bit for an opportunity, and they're going to make the most of it. And it starts with preseason game tomorrow and next Friday as well.
Yep, no, that's true. It should be interesting. I said we can talk about this. You know what? We'll talk about this after we have our interview with Steve Daniel, because it's a topic that is, you know, it is what it is right now for the next couple of weeks until their opener. But I was lucky enough to be able to speak with Steve Daniel, who is the CFL's head statistician, and he actually was able to shed some light, some very interesting light, on some of the things when it came to what does he do during the off season, and some very interesting comments when it comes to the preseason and how it can affect not only them but the teams that they are working for. So we'll listen to the interview, and when we get back, we'll continue with the show.
Stats, you know what? They're everywhere. What if you were able to meet the guy who is in charge of the entire stat complement for the CFL? What did it take to keep it up to date, etc.? Well, you know what? We have him this week. I have Steve Daniel on the line with us. His official title, and Steve, I'm going to ask you about this, CFL manager, game information and statistics, and head statistician for this CFL. Hey, well, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Close enough. I'm the director of game information and statistics, but really just means stats guy.
Okay, yeah, I was wondering, because I saw the thing here in the figures and records book. I keep wanting to call it a record and fact book, but it's the same thing. But Steve, how long have you been with the CFL doing this?
I joined the league in 2006. I was in the NBA from 1994 to 2004. Wound up in Memphis, Tennessee, and when I quit there, came back and got lucky enough to get this job. So about a decade.
I was about to say, it's pretty funny. The Grizzlies end up going to Memphis.
It was fun.
Yeah. I know you were at the beginning of the season itself. I mean, I'm sure your season's actually started way before this. But at the moment, we have the 2016 facts and figures and record book coming up. What does it usually take? What is your off season like when it comes to getting this thing ready to be obviously released to all the teams and then printed, et cetera, to the public?
It starts basically just as the whistle goes in the Grey Cup. So not a lot of time.
No.
This season, actually, off season is to divert just a little, is very different for us. Normally, I'd have a pretty good amount of time to think about what the guide should look like. I actually changed the title this year to what I really wanted all along.
Which was?
The 2016 CFL Guide and Record Book.
Oh, okay.
Much simpler. Normally, I have about 5 or 6 months to do it. But this year, our management and our clubs decided they would invest heavily in a brand new stat system. And that stat system resides behind the guide in one way.
Okay.
Because the system we had in the past that we've been using has grown basically out of date and inflexible. So that has taken up major amounts of my personal life over the last 18 months.
Mm-hmm.
And the system is now finished as of yesterday.
Nice.
Yesterday. So those
say,
two projects
and,
are pretty busy.
Yeah, I'm about to say, is it June yet? Yes, it is.
Wednesday.
It's because I see everything that's in here. I mean, I can just imagine the size of the database that you have compiled. And but let's go. Let's talk about just after you came back, or sort of came to the CFL. You had all the stats that were in front of you. Was it a daunting task? I mean, I can imagine there may have things that weren't done electronically. There were some that were done electronically. How big was the task to basically merge everything into the system that you have today?
Well, just to use your words that you used right now, yeah. Some were electronic.
Yeah.
That sum is a very small number.
Okay.
It basically handed me a paper copy of the 2006 Facts, Figures, and Records book and said, well, none of it's in a computer anywhere, and it's in a different language.
Oh, boy.
And we have nothing in a computer about our history, but it's all on paper there, so, you know, go for it. But actually, that's really good because my boss said, my boss is Kevin McDonald. Mm-hmm. He's the vice president of football operations. He said, listen, we know who you are. We trust what you bring to us from the NBA, and we'll do whatever you tell us to do statistically. Just let us know the direction you want to go. And
right.
My background is strategic planning from an earlier life. And so I said, well, on that basis, you have a deal. And so it makes it a lot easier, Tim, if you can get free rein to start building up records.
Right.
And now my approach was just simply to put them in fairly simple spreadsheets, but linked together,
mm-hmm.
to give you the answer to every question you can think of. That's a pretty broad scope, but why not?
Yeah. Yeah. And as people who listened to the podcast last week, yeah, just to mention that, I asked you a specific question, and you were within a couple of days, you were able to give me the answer. And it was something that I'll be honest with you. I wasn't even sure if, you know, what your system was like. You were able to give me the answer. So I was very impressed. How daunting was it to get basically up to date now? I mean, you come in, you had free reign, as you said. I'm sure, I don't know how much historical data you had to verify and go back and get.
I check everything.
Okay. But how was it? Was it a daunting task?
Here's the size of the task.
Okay.
Since 1907,
yeah.
We've had 5,304 different games, one of which was replayed. So 5,300 games is not a huge number.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we only have 81 regular season games a year, so it's not like it's the NFL where there's 252, or it's not like the NHL where there's, you know, well over 1,000.
Mm-hmm.
So the goal was to say, okay, let's find out everything we can about each game. So I spent a whole bunch of time in the UBC library verifying what was in some of the old guides they gave me. I have every CFL guide now back to 1950-something when they started.
Okay.
All those, there's some conflicts. And so I just sort of set the scope to be, let's find out all we can do. So now we have a database where we can reconstruct the statistics for pretty well any game we have. And was that daunting? Oh, my goodness. But it was a really important goal, I thought, Tim.
Well, you want something to be able to be obviously correct. You want to be able to answer questions that I'm sure that the broadcasters are going to be asking you. It's when it came to recreating this and getting it up to how you wanted it to be, what was the one thing that frustrated you the most? Maybe it was one stat or one player, or was there anything that really frustrated you when you finally got the information or got it down and said, finally?
Two things frustrate me the most. One, when things don't add up. And if you look at, say, the 1995 season and what was published in that particular guide,
mm-hmm.
a lot of areas don't add up. Or there's players missing from the guide, and you can't get the team totals, for example, to add to the player totals, which you'd expect.
Right.
And I go to such lengths today to make sure that there's none of these kinds of inconsistencies, but to see them in there is so hard. And the other part that frustrates me endlessly and still does today is, for very good reasons, however, unfortunately, I want to get all this stuff onto our website.
Yeah.
and I want to make it available to everybody as widely as we can. And we are working really hard at that. I've got a couple of colleagues that help with that. Mm-hmm. It frustrates me personally that we can't go fast enough. It doesn't frustrate me that my colleagues aren't doing it. They're wonderful. But I just wish it was so immediately available to people.
Right, right.
We'll get there.
Oh, I'm sure, yeah. I'll be one of them to look at the site and just check something immediately once it comes up. I'm sure I'll be one of the first.
Well, I love that kind of attitude because yeah. People really find value in it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm good with that. That helps me a lot.
We'll talk about some other stuff, but what is your – once we get into the regular season and you finally put your baby to bed, you know, the record – the media guide, the league media yep. guide, what do your weeks entail then? I mean, it's – what else do you do as far as when it comes to a weekly thing or whether it be for – if you do anything for individual teams, what's coming up for you for week one of the CFL season as an example?
Well, the preseason –
well, that too, yeah.
Preseason starts Wednesday from Winnipeg.
Mm-hmm.
It's a momentous day for us. Normally, it wouldn't be any big deal. Preseason games are really hard because there's no 46-man roster. There's 80-something.
Mm-hmm.
And so I manage the stats crews in each city. Those are the people that keep score. They have to know the rules. And so we have a very elaborate system to support them. So they're watching the field, they're keeping score, and they enter the data into our computer system. Well, they make mistakes, naturally, and it's normal. So my job every game is to sit at my computer in my office in Vancouver and watch what they enter and watch the field and make sure they're the same thing.
Okay.
Because the people who have the highest stake in it are our clubs and our players.
Right.
They got to know what's right. So if they're going to cut a guy or keep a guy, that's kind of important. Or who gets the sack? Is it this guy or is it that guy?
Mm-hmm.
Because they get paid on that basis. So you need to be fair. So that's – I monitor the games to make sure they're done properly. And in doing that, I extract other information that most people don't know about.
Okay.
And try to use that as well. So that's my round, is to monitor the games each week and then produce – information packages in advance of that game to say, this is what this game's about. And that occupies somewhere between 75 and 80 hours a week.
What happens when a game isn't televised? Because, you know, as everybody knows, this year the CFL, and the past couple years at least, the CFL hasn't televised all the preseason games.
Well, then I get very thankful for friends like Bob Irving in Winnipeg, for example, or Mark Steven in Calgary.
Mm-hmm.
They're my friends. They're the radio broadcasters. I have, at times, had to listen to them to verify preseason what's going on. So, for example, this Wednesday, the game is on television.
Mm-hmm.
But the preseason game after that is not. So that creates a kind of a tough dynamic. But we have Skype. I'll be on Skype with the crew watching the field, and they'll enter the data, and if it doesn't make sense, I can repair it.
Mm-hmm.
But it just requires a lot more communication when there's no television.
Oh, I'm,
in the
yeah.
regular season, it's a no-brainer. I have a recording system
right
in my office.
What would you say to the fans? And obviously, this is not just for the, you know, for the teams and stuff. They need the information. But what would you say to the fan to say, well, this is only preseason information. What kind of worth does it actually have? I mean, we don't see it in the end, so to speak. You know, stats wise.
That's a great question. Yeah. The highest value of all is for the clubs to determine whether they should keep this player or not keep this player.
Mm-hmm.
And so the preseason is really for them. Alone. When a starter goes in and plays one quarter of a game, it's hard to get much of an appreciation for his stat line, if you like.
Right.
So, and there's a second very critical part, especially this year, because we have a brand new stat system that's cost us a lot of money and it's a tremendous investment, is does the thing work? Does it calculate stuff right?
Mm-hmm.
Sure hope so.
Yeah. It, you know, I'm sure you want to make sure like the, cause I know they're different for particular leagues, like the quarterback rating. Those can be different for different leagues and stuff like that. So those are the type of variables that you have to modify before the game comes up and once you get the new program.
That's really funny actually, because the people that are building this new stat system are from New Jersey because they're so expert at it. They were the vendor that by far knew the most because we didn't have much time. And, they're basing a lot of stuff on NFL calculations. Well, last time I checked, they don't have rouges in the NFL. And nope. We do.
Nope. Yeah, I know it's calculated very differently. It's CFL, NFL, NCAA, the Arena League. I know they all have different calculations for that one particular thing. So it's
that's a challenge.
Yeah.
I watch NFL games to mine them for information. Mm-hmm. How do they present their information? Mm-hmm. It's my firm belief. I don't think they're as good as we are in presenting their information for – it's just a personal opinion. I think they do fine. But we're not bad either given the scale of our league.
Right. So many players have come through the CFL, and there's so many different types of stats that you could keep track of, and it sounds like you do. First, I have to ask, and I'm sure many people may be wondering this too. How many players have there been – in CFL history? Do you know?
To answer that, you have to slightly qualify it.
Okay.
Especially around Montreal, since Montreal was a really key player in the transition of the game from what Earl Grey said should be, that it should be an amateur game. The Grey Cup is supposed to go to the best amateur team in Canada.
Right.
Well, not anymore.
No.
But so that change from being an amateur endeavor to professional kind of started around the middle 1930s. And the Western League started in 1936. So I use 1936 as kind of a benchmark where we should start.
Okay.
And since 1936, I can identify 9,799 different individual players that have played at least one game.
Wow.
9,800 guys. And I have position and nationality and where they came from for about 99% of them. So there's a guy in Montreal, for example, in 1947. If one of your listeners has ever heard of him, help me out there.
Okay.
You know, he played six games in 1945. We'll use him as an example.
All right.
His name was Doug Ashton. Played for the last non-Montreal Alouette Montreal team in 1945. And I have no idea where he came from.
You're talking about highly, does that type of thing grate you? Grate at you? Get in your nerves? Get on your nerves?
Yes, it does.
There's information you haven't completed.
Right? I know there's 89 of these guys. I don't know whether they're Canadian or American. There's five of them that I don't have their positions for. But you don't want to just make it up. It's got to be real. So this list,
right,
to give you a sense of what we can know about say, one of the most famous Montreal players of all time. Let's look at one of your record holders, George Dixon. My goodness, he was a good player. He played in the 60s. He was a running back. And he was so good. So we know he's a running back from Bridgeport, a school in, I think, Connecticut.
Yes, it is, yeah.
NCAA player, American, played from 1959 to 65, 7 years, 76 games, etc. Two Grey Cups, or twice an All-Star, no Grey Cups, and in the Hall of Fame. So that's the litany of information we can tell you about him, plus a bunch of other stuff. Mm-hmm. But just that's his kind of what you might call profile. We have that for everybody.
Wow.
So it was fun to put together.
Is it fair to say when people look at the league media guide that not all players are listed? Because I know you have a grouping of players that are there. You don't have everybody that's in there. Where would you say would be the cutoff date of people that you want to keep track of?
A couple of years
or
ago.
Or show to the public.
In there we list all the current players. So it's a kind of a constant argument between how much of the book is dedicated to players today and how much we can dedicate to players in the past. So, for example, anyone's in the Hall of Fame is in there. And I had I have a retired player section I started 2 years ago to take the top 1,000 players.
Right.
Make sure they're still in there. Because here's the principle, Tim. My view is that a player who ever played in our league in 1982 is every bit as important as a player playing in 2016. And, you know, because they were part of it and made a major contribution to it. And like Sam Etchberry, legendary quarterback, I try to put him in the book everywhere I can. Because there's a guy that, you know, clearly one of the best players in our history.
Yeah.
Or even somebody like Kyrie Zabert. Mm-hmm. We try to make sure everything we can get about him is in there. So they're just as valid then as they are now. But I'd say we try to cover everybody at least a little.
Now, you have, as I said, you have your preseason stuff. I want to just revisit this for a second. What does your post-game ritual usually look like? I know, obviously, sometimes things may not be correct. Does the league send out the game books immediately, or is it you have to make sure that all the stats are done properly? Because obviously everything that is done by the teams is put into the computer, and it is also, unless I'm wrong here, it is also being shown through the live stats that the league produces.
You can save yourself a lot of trouble by doing what I do, and that is I audit the game as it goes along. So as the people in the press box in Montreal add data for the game, and they're good at it, I validate the plays as they happen rather than waiting until the end. By the time we get to the game, the end of the game, I can within – it used to take us about an hour, but the little program that I run kind of beside our stat system, I just have to look at it for about a minute, and I can know that for the most part it's going to be just fine. The toughest stat for us, of course, because the players can test them, is tackles. Most fans don't realize that the players are competitive around who gets them. Simply because we only can give one guy for a tackle.
And bonuses, too, can be huge on those things, too.
So these things matter. So the answer to the question is, within about 5 minutes at the end of the game, I'm satisfied enough to give a set of game stats to the clubs, knowing that I won't likely have to make any changes. And we just built this new stat system. And built into it is if you make a mistake entering the data, like you put a punt block on an incomplete pass, it won't let you do that. Whereas our old system, you could do anything and it would look at you blankly and say, okay, I guess so. But now it won't let you do that. So I love the process of making it right as the game goes on, because it's not an easy thing to do, but it's really worth it. So 5 minutes, we're done.
Nice.
And I send out an email, and everyone who wants that email can have it. All I need is their email address, and they're perfectly entitled to it.
When it comes to requests, whether it be from fans, whether it be from the guys over at TSN or RDS, what has been the what has been the most requested type of
absolutely,
yeah,
it's a no-brainer. What's that quarterback done against the league and against this team tonight, and what's his record as a starter? That's the most requested piece of information ever, and that did not exist before 2 years ago. And now it does for every player all time, because I thought that was the most important thing people wanted. So it's a function of listening to what people ask for the most and then deriving the data to do it. You know, some people will ask me the weirdest things, and I can't always help. But in game, I have just enough time. If TSN wants to know something in the moment, I'm directly connected to their stats guys in the stadium.
Oh, nice. Okay.
So
okay.
The guy, I will mention his name because he's such a wonderful individual, and he'll work your Montreal games for you for TSN. His name is John Russin. John is, we go back 25 years together, back to our NBA days, and we understand one another very well. And so when he wants something, I'll give it to him, because it goes straight to the broadcaster's mouth. And that's a thrill for me.
You ever come up with a strange request? Like, they may be – obviously, you're going to be keeping up on all the upcoming records and whatnot that the players and the teams are maybe setting. Has there ever been a weird request for a record that you didn't know about? That sounded like a loaded question.
It happens all the time. Yeah. Although, think of, okay, what's the most yards a team's ever gained in the third quarter? Well, I don't know. Because our records really only relate to a full game. But I can get a little creative. Since 2008, there are ways to find that out, but they're just a little convoluted.
Right.
And so they'll ask me for those sorts of dimensions that, okay. And one of the things that I try to do, though, Tim, is if they ask me a question, and my background's in archaeology, and you can't answer an archaeological question without giving what you call context.
Right.
Here's what you're really asking me, I think. And they'll say, oh, yeah, right, I guess so. Like yesterday somebody asked me how many left-handed quarterbacks there are in the history of the CFL, and are they rare? And I said, yes, but you have to take one other thing into account. Why they're rare? Because, A, there are not that many of them. What, 9% of the population is left-handed? But it's because most teams have their best blocker on the left side because the quarterback can't see over his left shoulder.
Okay.
That's why there's relatively few left-handed quarterbacks. Like Stephen LaFors simply wasn't very good. Nice man, but not very good quarterback. Tim Tebow?
Yep.
Those guys, the game is a right-handed game. That's like hockey. 9% of the population is left-handed. I got to say 60% of the NHL players are left-handed, are they not? That's an unusual.
Yeah.
There's a reason for that. Or else it wouldn't be.
They got to ask this. Has there ever been an ambidextrous quarterback?
Yeah. There was one.
Really?
Yeah. I know it. I just forget.
Oh, it's okay. I sprung it on you too. I didn't mean to do that. So
I don't know. I have seen it. Like, there's an ambidextrous baseball pitcher right now.
There was a former Expos one that was ambidextrous. I can't remember his name either, but I know there was.
I watched one the other day. There are rules about having you can only do so much of an at bat left-handed and right-handed.
And you can't switch him in the middle of an at bat. Yeah.
No. Baseball's the only game I've never worked professionally. I've worked soccer and basketball and all sorts of sports. But the only baseball I've worked, and that's my favorite game, is at the amateur level, which I love keeping score of baseball games.
Now, all the time that you've been with the CFL and all the time that you've been doing the stats for the CFL, I mean, what is the one thing, whether it be a stat, whether it be something that you've done, what is the one thing that has stood out the most? I can't necessarily will define your career as a head statistician, but what is the one thing that really stands out in your mind that during a conversation that's something you want to make sure that you bring up?
That we have been able to reconstruct our history so that we can know what happened in any particular game. If you ask for something about a particular game or a particular individual, we can now do that. And that it is undoubtedly it's like the relationship I have with my wife, which is perfect. It's a work in progress. It's you're always going to find out something new. And that's why when history is static, that's no good. It's dynamic. And so we add something about every single game. So I guess my one favorite thing is that when I got the job, I had it for a while, and I got to about 2010, and I thought, what do I do next? And that next was the Grey Cup. And now I rewatched every single play in the video age of the Grey Cup, which is 1953 on. I have all that video. And rescored the Grey Cup.
Oh, wow.
And checked every last Grey Cup play. So there's a gentleman from the media in Ottawa, Gord Holder, who's a wonderful reporter, and he wanted to do an expose on the 1976 Ottawa Grey Cup game. And I could tell him what happened in every play and why. and that's fun.
As I said, the new media guide's about to, I said, was just put to bed. If a fan wants to get a hold of one this season, would you know how they would be able to do so?
Yes, just if they could write into CFL.ca, mm-hmm. there's a feedback, or contact our communications people, Lucas Barrett or Paolo Senra at the CFL office. They will have copies of the guide starting on Monday. The guide got completed yesterday afternoon while we were out on my bike for a little bit with riding around. And like, I put them on my doorstep. They're printed, and they look really good. We're proud of them. They will be available to the fans starting on Monday.
Okay. Being it that, can we give our fans an exclusive? And can you tell us who's on the cover or what's on the cover?
Well, it was going to be a fight between Mike Riley,
okay.
who led his team to the Grey Cup. And I have to divert slightly and say that Mike Riley, I've spoken with him on a number of occasions, and he is one of the most thoughtful individuals alongside the person who did wind up on the cover. I've spoken to them both. And Henry Burris is your guy.
Okay.
We usually use the most outstanding player from the previous year. And Henry's a great example because of his long career. Statistically, he's right up there too.
Mm-hmm.
There's a guy who started, 220 some odd games? That's pretty good.
Yeah. So I will
admit, Mr. Burris.
Yep, okay. So you guys heard it here first. Steve, it's been just even our talk prior to the interview. It's phenomenal what you do, and I am in awe of what you've been able to do. And it gives me a perspective of what goes into keeping track of all the stats for the CFL and the league that we love. So it was a pleasure to talk with you, sir, and I hope to talk with you in the very near future too.
The pleasure's all mine. Anytime that I get asked for information, I love giving it because it makes people feel good and it helps them do what they do. So pleasure's all mine. Thank you, Tim.
Now, I know it really wasn't – you know, the interview with Steve really wasn't Alouettes-related, you know, 100%, but it was very interesting to get him on the podcast to actually – you know, he really did give us a little bit of enlightenment on quite a bit of stuff that they do across the league.
Absolutely. And also too, like if you're a stats geeks like we are, like you're soaking this up. You're enjoying mm-hmm. the fact that you can, you know, this guy, he does this for a living. Like this is his passion and he gets to live his dream, so to speak. And it, like I said,
he's been giving he's been very literally been given carte blanche with what he wants to do. You know, coming from the NBA to the CFL and doing what he's doing now, and it's interesting to notice that basically, you know, usually with myself or players or stuff like that, you know, usually if you follow the league, we as fans, we have downtime. You know, maybe we'll jump over to the NFL or whatnot, but him, as soon as it starts, as soon as the, you know, as he said, as soon as it Grey Cup ends, his next season starts to be able to determine how they're gonna do the next media guide. So it's very enlightening. Very, very, very cool. Very, very cool. And if anybody ever gets a chance to talk to him, as I said, if you love stats, I loved it. I was just, as you said, I love the interview. It's just one of the coolest interviews I think I've ever done in my podcasting history. So, I know probably many of you have not heard the different ones that I've done over my other one. For arena football, but this ranks right up there. I'm a stats geek, and hopefully we'll bring that in. We're thinking of a few things we might be able to do in the next couple of weeks, where we might have a small segment, a stats segment. But we need to talk about. We'll have to talk a little bit more about that and determine where we're gonna go with it. But yeah. Hey, by the way, I thought something's very, very strange. But either way, yeah. Thanks, Steve, for joining us this week. We talked about it last week, Gerald Brown, you know, all of a sudden retires. And then we see today, you know, thanks Herb letting us know. He's back with the Owls. He's back with the Argos. Little asterisk. As a guest coach. We found that a little bit interesting, didn't we?
Yeah, it's just funny how this league works out sometimes. Like I said, last week we talked about the fact that Gerald had decided to call it a career, and now magically he's back as a coach, a guest coach, mind you, but still, he's still able to impart some wisdom. And I think at the end of the day, the football bug, once it gets a hold of you, it's so hard to let it go. And I think, as I speculated, and it was just speculation on my part, because again, you'd have to hear from Gerald himself. If you don't feel you can perform at the same level that you're used to, then you're sometimes better off just to ride off into the sunset. But I still think for him, that football fire burns, and just maybe he may not have it physically, but mentally it must still be there. Because otherwise, why else would you want to come back and be a coach or a guest coach or however you want to phrase it? But I think for him, there's still very much a football fire inside of him. And I think he thinks that this is the best way to get your football fix and still be able to contribute something, not just to the Argos, but also to this league as well.
Yeah, because we've seen many an Alouettes player come back and be whether it be a coach on another team or AC is a very good example of somebody who is still very dedicated to the sport itself. He's now our OC, our co-OC, or assistant OC, whatever you want to call him.
No, he's just the offensive coordinator now. He doesn't share it. This is his show. This is his party.
Yeah, so we've seen many. They've gone on to bigger and better things, and whether it be in the CFL or elsewhere. So it's obviously a love of the sport. If you're old enough and you don't think you can play anymore, or the teams don't necessarily want you anymore, there may be another opportunity for you. So it's good on him. Good on him. I mean, he's able to continue with what he wants to do. He loves the league. So, interesting thing that came over social media today, and it's something that you and I have talked about before, just in passing and whatnot. Even before that, we did the podcast, and I'm sure many a fan of us also talked about this too. But some reason, whether it was a slip of the tongue or whether it was intentional, Jim Popp let it be. He actually told us somebody. On somebody new on the Al's negotiation list.
Mm-hmm. We did find out that there's another player that they've got their eye on. And it's funny, usually when you hear about the negotiation list, you hear like NFL names, and it's just sort of a pie in the sky thing. Like, believe it or not, Tim Tebow is still on the Alouettes negotiation list.
Oh, come on.
If God forbid he ever wanted to continue his football career, and I'm sorry to say, I still have not seen any indication that he is serious in any way, shape, or form about wanting to continue his football career on a professional level. Mm-hmm. But God forbid if he ever wanted to do it in the Canadian Football League, it would still have to go through Montreal.
All I can say about Tebow is, dear God, no.
that's the Pittsburgh Steelers fan of 2011 talking there.
Yeah, no. Well, I've had my fair share. Remember, AC got a tryout for the Steelers, so everything can't be all that bad. So, I'm trying to remember what year that was that he got a tryout for it with the Steelers.
It was 2003, just after he had won the Grey Cup.
There you go. There you go. Now we're talking about that. What is your opinion on the neg list? Everybody has heard about this list. We know it's kept very, very secret. The Owls are able to trade a first round draft pick for somebody on the neg list, and we're able to sign him. Luckily, we're able to sign him to a 3-year contract and a potential future starting quarterback. What's your take on the neg list?
To tell you the truth, it should be made public. You can make arguments for or against it all day long, but at the end of the day, it's just going to create more fodder for fans. It's going to give them stuff to talk about, and it's kind of fun too, just to see. Like, there's probably a lot of names on the list that you wouldn't know from a hole in the wall, But it's still interesting nonetheless to see, okay, well, who's in the pipeline? Who's coming down that could potentially possibly be a future CFL star? Now, you look at some of the bigger names on there, and of course, like I said, this is never going to happen. Likely it won't. But again, just for the sake of getting a conversation going, getting people interested in certain things, and also, too, for the players that are on said negotiation list, if people are talking about them, Lord knows they're going to want to perform, especially if they're at the collegiate level, if nothing else. The dream is always going to be to go to the NFL. We get that. But if you still want to play football professionally for a living, the CFL is still very much a very attractive option. And if people know, hey, so-and-so, he's on, I don't know, Saskatchewan's list, or he's on Hamilton's list, that's going to create some buzz. That's going to create a little bit of excitement. And best of all, it's people talking. Well, what if my team swung a deal with that team to get that guy on the neg list? There's endless possibilities as far as I'm concerned. I think it should be made public. I don't see the harm in it, quite frankly. I mean, I don't think it weakens or strengthens anyone's position, because again, at the end of the day, it comes down to negotiation. That's what it is. It's a negotiation list. So you can go out and trade and get, Tim Tebow, for example. You can go and get his rights, but at the end of the day, you still got to be able to negotiate with him and convince him to come play for your team.
I'm going to do it again. Oh, God, no.
Believe me. It's never going to happen.
Well, the problem with a Tebow type of person is that this is not the league that you're going to get Rocket Ismail type of money anymore. There's no way. And, I think it also, and I know it's not a negless thing, but I'm sure this could be another topic for another day, is what's happening with the overall number one pick in the CFL for Saskatchewan. He's holding out.
Yep.
So, I mean, it's, but yeah, the negless to me, I think it needs to be. I understand the reasons why the coaches want to keep it quiet, because they will not know who is on the said team's neg list. But it would create great topics, great conversations, great fodder for fans and for reporters across the league to be able to know who is on said team or who they're trying to get to come. And be able to determine, this guy really would look good here, or, because obviously we know that with the way if a guy's, he may go to the NFL, he could still be drafted, as everybody knows from the CFL, he can still be drafted, he may still just go ahead and go to the NFL, or try to go to the NFL, and then if that doesn't pan out, then comes to the CFL. Mm-hmm. But we've seen many a player where that's the case, where we haven't seen them for, what, four years, 5 years, whatever it may be. I think 5 years is too much. But you understand what I'm getting at.
Yeah. I mean, again, it's not exactly a great example because it's not really about negotiation lists. But you look at, say, Philip Blake and Vaughn Martin, who are now with the Alouettes. But originally, when they were drafted, they had NFL aspirations. And despite the fact that they were Canadian-born players, they could be drafted – they were still very much highly sought at by NFL teams.
Right.
So it took a while for these guys to even come up here. But if nothing else, it still gives you the speculation. It still gives you a chance to sort of wonder, well, okay, if it doesn't pan out, could these guys come up here? Could these guys adjust to the CFL game after playing their college ball in the United States and then also playing for a number of NFL teams or being on their practice rosters or whatnot? Because there's still an adjustment period coming from the NFL to the Canadian Football League. Everybody thinks it's going to be easy or something like that. Well, no, it's not going to be easy. It's a completely different game altogether. Well, it's the same but different, as I like to say.
Right.
And there's still going to be adjustments to be made. There's still little nuances that have to be looked after. So a lot of the speculation can be can so-and-so adjust to the Canadian game and flourish for my team? Mm-hmm. And that's part of the fun of it as well. So you're not just looking at negotiation list players like that, but you're also looking at a lot of Canadian talent is really getting some good hard looks down in the United States. And yeah, CFL teams will eventually draft them, if only to be able to say that, well, just in case it doesn't pan out, then at least we've got this guy that can come up in a couple of years. And Montreal's had that for the past couple of seasons, and will probably still have it for years to come.
Oh, I think. Well, I said I've heard both sides of it, and I think portions of the negalist should be made available. I guess it just depends on how it would be set up to do just that. But it's, it doesn't have to be. I mean, you got to admit, anybody who's in the know probably does know what is on the negalist. I've seen Herb talk about stuff, people being on the negalist when we're like, what? Or same thing with Didier. I'm sure he himself has the sources that can tell him who a particular player, if they're on the Isles negalist or not.
Well, that's it. And again, if these reporters can get their hands on it or find out, by whatever means they do, it's not so secret then at that point. So, I mean, like at that point, you may as well let the cat out of the bag. May as well, like I said, if for no other reason to get people talking about it, get people excited. Like, what's the harm in that? What's the harm in getting people interested in the potential that perhaps, like I said, like a Russell Wilson or a Colin Kaepernick, like they're never going to come to the Canadian Football League. Or if they do, it's going to be like a one in a million shot. Mm-hmm. But you look at some of the other players, like Braxton Miller, for example, is on Montreal's negotiation list.
Vince Ferragamo. Now, That's our next guy, Vince Ferragamo. He's our next quarterback.
But seriously, Braxton Miller, who was drafted in the NFL draft this year, there's still a chance that he could come up to Canada one day because he was originally quarterback, switched to receiver.
Yeah.
If it doesn't pan out in the NFL for whatever reason, that opens up a whole new opportunity. Could he come back and could he be a great receiver in the CFL? Or could he go back to being a quarterback and possibly be another great quarterback for this league? I mean, the possibilities are endless. I mean, and this is part of the speculation. This is part of the fun of having a public negotiation list. I mean, it's not about who's got who or whatnot, but it's just a matter of it gets people talking, gets people thinking about things. You start, having like sort of fantasy football scenarios, if you will, about this. So to me personally, I just can't see a negative to making negotiation list public.
Okay, there's a lot of questions. If we can, I'm sure there'll be many questions that we can ask Mark Whiteman. Got to get our guys on that. It's hard to believe we're saying this so early within June, but we have a game, Cliff. We got a game, and as we're taping, we have a game in just over 21 hours. The game will be in Winnipeg. Montreal's 2016 team will take the field. Game will be on TSN. I think it's going to be on the main channel, but one of the four games are going to be on TSN this year for preseason. I happen to catch a sneak peek of the depth chart for the game, and some things are actually very interesting. I know we were talking about before about center. Matthew Toppin is second string. Mm-hmm. Or sorry, I shouldn't say that. That's not the right. He's second in line behind Christian Matt. Let's put it that way.
Yes.
But it's funny. We talk about, we have Vernon Adams. He's currently fifth. He's fifth on the depth chart. Considering what the Alouettes signed him for, now it depends on how much of that is actually guaranteed. Kevin Glenn, Rakeem Cato, completely got Brandon Bridge. That's not what we heard before. I was under the impression. Now, mind you, obviously things can change from the way that they're printed. It's like the internet. You can't always believe what you read. Because I get sworn, as we mentioned before, that Jim Potts said that Brandon Bridge was going to get some reps behind Kevin Glenn. But we could be wrong. Anything can change. How do you think about what they did with slot back? I know it's only the first game of preseason, but what do you think about them putting Kenny Stafford behind SJ Green? Don't you think that he'd be a little bit more of a threat?
Again, I think it's like everything else in this offense, everything's going to be a work in progress. I do kind of like the idea that both SJ and – again, you got SJ and Daron Carter. Like, that's your 1-2 punch right there. But again, to have like Kenny Stafford and Nick Lewis as your guys behind them, that's not too bad to have either. Is there a way that you could sort of spread them out a little bit and get them out of the slot? It's very possible. I think as Anthony Calvillo and Jacques Chapdelaine take a look at what the receivers do and how, especially once it comes to actual game time, I think we'll see a few more adjustments. And these guys are pretty versatile as well. So, I mean, they can't just all stay in the slot. I definitely think that they're going to have to spread them out. And maybe we'll even see a few four or five receiver sets as well, where you're going to see these guys sort of slot in different areas as well. So if nothing else, I'm excited to see what's going to happen tomorrow. And I can't believe it's less than 24 hours. Do we get to see some actual game footage, some actual honest to goodness playing time? So I'm stoked. There's no other way to describe it.
It should be fun. But I was going to mention this before. That's why I wanted to wait till now to talk about it. As much as I love the Owls, there's so much when it comes to determining who is going to be on the starting roster for 2016. I don't know. I like seeing Alouettes games on TV in the preseason and going to the first preseason game because it gets me back in the stadium, seeing all my old friends again that I sit around. But I don't know. I just can't take it. I just don't take them as seriously as regular season games. Maybe that's sacrilege to some people out there. And it's not that I'm not a true fan. I'm just the type of person, like, I'm glad to see them. But it's just like, okay. It's unless something drastically happens. Mind you, we've seen the weirder things happen in the CFL, especially with the Alouettes. We know that Kevin Glenn, SJ Green, Duron Carter, we know they're going to be there. And Kenny Stafford, from what they signed him at, Nick Lewis also. BJ Cunningham is a name that is a very important name to watch too, especially a wide receiver. Sam Ejiguer, which was last year, just because I think of the quarterback situation, was very underutilized. I think you'll agree with me on that one.
I've said that as much, yes.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe I just need to get. Maybe it's just me having to get into CFL mode again. And it's, to me, I said preseason's preseason. It's sort of like what Steve said in the interview when it comes to preseason. They're doing the stats. They're there to determine who they want on each team. The coaches want on each team. It's like, okay, I guess I'm the type of person. It's like, let's just get beyond that. Let's get to the first game of the season. But it's better. I guess the better to have the preseason rather than to have the preseason carry over to week one, right? Which sometimes it does, but. That's not to the fault of the coaches, though.
No, and I guess over the past few years, like, I was never a huge fan of preseason as well, because I was very much of that same opinion as you, is like, let's just get this going already. But now that I've had a chance to really sit and watch training camps and just start evaluating players as well, like, now to me, I'm more interested in seeing just the progression of these guys, seeing what they've picked up from this coaching staff, and also to being with the other players as well, like, just to see. Truly, as far as talent evaluation, and coaches have even said they don't care about the wins and losses when it comes to that. At the end of the day, it's all about evaluation. It's all about seeing what each player brings to the table. And can they be a fit on this team, or are they just relegated to the practice roster, or will they just be cut loose? And it's just a matter of, to me, that's what I find fascinating above all else, is just seeing who's on the cusp, who's just like one or two steps away from really truly being a member of this team, like who could potentially be on the practice roster
becoming a superstar.
Well, that's it. And it doesn't happen overnight. Like, a lot of these guys have to put their time in. They got to pay their dues on the practice roster and hope and pray that someone gets hurt. So just so they can get their shot at.
It's so bad. I know that's so bad to say that, I know, but it's like, hope he gets hurt.
Well, that's it. I'm sure nobody wants.
Mind you, I just got to say two names. It's it was Drew Bledsoe and Tom Brady.
Tom Brady, yes. And again, I'll give you the best example. Like 2013 season, when Duron Carter, he made the team on the practice roster. And I remember watching this kid, and I thought, my word, like, I knew he was Chris Carter's son. And I thought, if he should be just half as good as his old man, we'll be okay. And what happened? Jamel Richardson gets hurt, blows out his knee. in comes De'Ron Carter. Next thing you know, we just found our next superstar, just like that. That's how quickly it happens in this league. You got guys that you don't know from, like I said, you don't know these guys from a hole in the wall, and within 2-3 games, they're not only in the starting lineup, but oh my gosh, they're making plays. They're making highlight reel plays. And next thing you know, everybody is clamoring for a De'Ron Carter or a Kenny Stafford or someone else who, you know, the year previous was just some guy on the practice roster. You don't know, where'd this guy come from? Like, well, this is where he came from. This is how you see the talent that you have available. And if these guys have the talent they say they do, you can't hide talent. It's going to be shown, and everybody's going to see it as well. That's how I look at it.
No, it's like, fair.
It's about the evaluation. It's about seeing what you have, and again, it just reflects back on the coaching staff. It reflects back on the scouts. It reflects back on everyone within the organization as to, okay, where are you going to find the next S.J. Green or John Bowman or Anthony Calvillo? Like, who's going to be the ones that will take up the reins for the future? I'm like, well, this is how you find out. Maybe, like I said, this guy's not a household name yet, but maybe one day he will be. Or he could be a complete bust. We'll never know. But the only way you're going to find out is give these guys the playing time. And that's what makes preseason, to me anyways, really interesting.
Right. And I'm going to go ahead and say, since we really can't make a prediction for the game itself, that it is preseason, of the quarterbacks, which do you think is going to, that's a weird question really, but of the quarterbacks that they currently have listed, you know, Glenn, Rakeem Cato, Brandon Bridge, Taj Boyd, and if Vernon Adams gets in there, and two others, who is it, was it Jimmy Underdahl?
Drew Burko and Jimmy Underdahl? Burko. Two Canadian kids?
Yep. And there's one more. We have another guy.
Yeah, if you're a quarterback, come on down.
John?
Yeah.
Which quarterback needs to make the best showing tomorrow night?
In my opinion, it's got to be Rakeem Cato.
Yeah, I agree.
I find that... last year, and his training camp this year is, in my opinion, a bit of a microcosm of his season last year. Some flashes of brilliance, but a lot of struggling. And I don't know if it's struggling to just get noticed or struggling to find that rhythm with his receivers and that, but I'm still waiting to be impressed. I hate to say it sounded like that, but I'm still waiting to be impressed by Rakeem Cato in 2016. All the other quarterbacks, I've seen flashes of brilliance. Nobody's been perfect by no stretch of the imagination.
Right.
But there's something with Cato. Like, it just seems like it's like an engine. Just you got to build up to it. And you just can't afford to do that, especially when he does have actual CFL experience. So there's, as far as I'm concerned, like, there's no excuse. Like, he's got to be able to perform. And if he doesn't show out on these two preseason games, then I'm really not liking his odds of sticking around, quite frankly.
I'm looking for debut-wise. I'm actually, because I saw just a touch of him, but what I've heard from you and what I've heard from others, I'm really interested to see if he gets some snaps as Vernon Adams. I'm really curious to see how this guy does in a real game situation, you know, not a scrimmage situation. So,
no, like I said, there's a... It's a very small sample size so far, but everything I've seen from Adams is I'm impressed. I actually caught a little bit of heat on Twitter by saying, jokingly, I should say, that we might have fleeced BC in this trade to get Adams. But again, you won't know for sure until you see him taking some actual reps.
Yeah, but
It's all speculation, right?
I can laugh at your tweet too, because if you think about it, it's a number one pick, which we don't even know who the hell they're going to try, who BC may pick up. For all we know, watch them trade their pick.
It's too early, and there's no guarantee that this is going to be the first overall pick. I know a couple of journalists have snidely suggested that Montreal may have just traded the first overall pick. Like, well, why don't you give the Alouettes a little bit of credit? Come on.
And we'll get to that more, I think, in the next 2 weeks. Cliff and I will talk about where we think the Owls are going to be at the end of the 2016 season. So we have a few more weeks to talk about and think about that. So But everybody, obviously, the game's tomorrow, and I enjoy it. It's the first game of the season, no matter where you are in the CFL landscape. And by the way, if you do want to contact us or visit us on social media, there are multiple ways that you can do so. First, if you want to email us, you can do so at alouettespodcast@gmail.com. We are on Facebook. Just friend us, and we will add you. We are also on Twitter at alouettesfldeck. And the podcast and all of its archives are currently, we are on Podbean, and we are on now officially on iTunes, and in the very next couple of days, we should be getting onto Google Play Music. So I just want to say I want to thank all of you who listened to the first show. I was very impressed. I'm very excited that so many people are interested in listening to what we have to say. So it's any ideas that you guys can give us, any constructive criticism, please send it our way. Also, Cliffy and I are on Twitter. He's at Cliffy D. I'm at Repact, R-E-P-P-A-C-T. So should enjoy the game, right, Cliff? Should be good tonight, tomorrow night to see it. I know I will have to tape and watch it because I am taping something else tomorrow night. But I will make sure that I do watch the game so we can chat about it next week.
Absolutely. And again, this is what we've been waiting for. We've been waiting for this since last November, is some more Alouettes football. So we're finally going to get it this time tomorrow. And like I said, I'm excited. And just speaking to your point earlier with the podcast, like, I'm very happy that a lot of people have reached out to us and have been very encouraging. And I just want to say thank you so much to everybody, because again, at the end of the day, we're doing this for you, the fans. Like I said, not just fans of the Alouettes, but fans of the Canadian Football League as well. And I'm also very excited that more podcasts are starting to come out. Like, in addition to the ones that are already being established, everybody's been clamoring for a Saskatchewan Rough Riders podcast. Apparently, that's going to be coming out any day now. Toronto apparently is still trying to get their things worked out to try and get a podcast for them. So I'm hoping that by the time the season kicks off in a couple of weeks, maybe we'll have finally all nine CFL teams completely represented by a fan podcast. And to me, that's what it's all about. That's, to me, is what the CFL community is all about. It's all about sharing football, enjoying football, talking about football in any way, shape, or form. And honestly, I couldn't be more excited at this venture. And like I said, I still think the best is yet to come for us.
It should be great. And as I said, we plan on being here next week, talk about more about what happened in the preseason game with the Owls and the Bombers, and to move forward within the 2016 season. So for everybody here at Alouette's Flight Deck, for Cliffy D, I'm Tim Capper. We're on Final Approach.